lots of things. So I'm going to start off, well, let's do an outline real quick. First we'll talk about length and geometric series. That'll incorporate Zeno's famous paradox. Next we'll talk about Archimedes' method for determining the area under a parabolic curve. For instance, I don't know if the St. Louis Arch is actually parabolic, but determining the area under something like that. Next we'll talk about calculating area under a general curve. This will be towards defining the definite integral itself. And then lastly, we'll talk about the application of the definite integral, which will be finding the volume of a cone, which was, invented when we invented calculus, but certainly much easier to do once we have calculus. Maybe nation three categories down a little bit, but definitely calculus. And throughout the talk, the emphasis will be on approximating complicated shapes by more simple geometric shapes. So we'll talk a little bit about that as we go on. But first, let's start off with some really basic stuff. So suppose we have a strip of length 1. Okay. For instance, we could have a ruler. A ruler that's 1 foot long. Okay. How many ways can we chop up this ruler into different pieces such that the sum of all the individual pieces is still 1? There's a whole lot of ways, right? The answer is pretty boring if we emphasize that there can only be a finite number of pieces. So for instance, what could we do? We could say, we're going to chop it up into 2 pieces. More pieces. We can chop it up into 4 pieces. Each 1/4 foot long, so 3 inches. Okay. Pick your favorite number. You could even chop it up into n equals 34 billion pieces. Okay, so never mind how we'd actually do this in practice, but in theory, we could chop this up to a bunch of really tiny pieces, okay, and there would be 34 billion pieces, all of length 1 over 34 billion inches. If you add all those little slivers up, you still get 1 foot. Okay, so this is a really boring question when we're talking about a finite number of chops. But what happens if we do an infinite number of chops? Can we still add up an infinite amount of things and still get 1? So we'll talk about this. A good place to introduce Zeno's paradox. Okay? So Zeno was an ancient Greek philosopher of, Elea, I guess. And to support another famous Greek philosopher's, Parmenides, to support his theories, he came up with a series of different paradoxes. Okay? And the one we'll examine today is the so-called dichotomy paradox. And it's meant to illustrate that all motion is an illusion. It's illusory. You can't have any motion. And here's what Zeno's argument said. Okay, Homer, ancient Greek Homer, wants to catch a bus. It'll take him to the Olympics. The buses probably weren't around in ancient Greek times, but this is a mixed story, so we can do whatever we want. Okay, he begins to walk towards the bus stop. However, to get to the bus stop, he's got to go halfway there. Before he goes halfway there, he's got to go 1/4 of the way there. Before he goes 1/4 of the way there, he's got to go 1/8 of the way there. And so on and so forth. Okay? So in order to walk, say, here's Homer, I'm Homer for a second. And the bus stop is that wall. In order to walk to the bus stop, to the wall, Zeno maintains that I have to do, that I have to complete an infinite amount of tasks. That is, go halfway there, go a quarter way there, go an eighth of the way there, go a sixteenth of the way there, and so on and so forth. Okay, so he says this is impossible. Homer Simpson, I think, would rather not think or contemplate of completing an infinite amount of tasks. I think he just wants to stay where he is with his donuts. Okay, so the paradox is such. There's another sort of way you could twist the paradox and say, well, not only can he not complete the trip because he has an infinite number of tasks to complete, he can't even start the trip. Why can he not start the trip? To start the trip, you have to go a single distance. You have to start with some distance. It could be a smidgen. It could be a big old step. You have to start with something. Okay? But to start with something, you have to start by going halfway of that something. In other words, if you start by going, I don't know, 1/100th of the way here to the wall, you also have to go 1/200th of the way. So you can never start. So not only can you not complete the task, you can't even start it. So what the heck is going on? Because very obviously I can go step, 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 step. And here I am at the wall, right? So did I resolve Zeno's paradox? What's going on here? What gives? What gives? Archimedes, who was a brilliant mathematician in antiquity, offered a resolution that's based on modern calculus. The idea of taking limits. We'll talk a little bit about that. So we'll introduce a little notation. I apologize if most or all of you have seen this, but it doesn't hurt if someone has not. So when we talk about the Greek letter sigma, it should look like an S, and it stands for a sum. So for instance, let's see up there, I have the sum I equals 1 to 5 of I. Now what is this I? Why did I, where did I come from? Any functions yet?
Like I equals I is a function.
That's right. So in general, if you want to think about this as having some function of I, you're absolutely right. What I was looking for is that this is a so-called dummy variable. It's just a summation index. So what it says is we go back to a concrete function that I have before. I, this just says let I equal 1, that's where it starts. You go 1, okay, now you increment I. Now you sum this thing I equals 2. And you do it all the way to the upper bound of the sum 5. And that's where you stop. Okay? So are we all comfortable with this, I think? Probably should be. So, alright, back to Zeno's paradox. Paul, Zeno said, Homer, you've got to go an infinite amount, you've got to complete an infinite amount of tasks. How are you going to do this? After completing the first task, he's halfway there. So he's gone, let's draw a picture instead of having me try to walk the wall every time. Here's Homer. Right here. He's got a little donut. He hasn't taken a bite yet, but he will. Okay, and here's the bus stop. Okay, so here's halfway. Now, the first task he has to complete is to go halfway, right? So, let's say he's halfway there. He's completed the first task. Now, and, say he completes the second task. He goes halfway from the halfway point to the bus stop. To the bus. Okay. So this is now 3/4 of the way. This is first task. Zeno assigns him. Here's the second task. Zeno assigns him. Go halfway from the halfway point, right? Okay, so it's pretty clear. After completing the third task, he'll be halfway from 3/4 the entire way. He'll be 7/8 of the way to the bus stop. Alright? So what we're interested in is finding where Homer is after completing the nth task. Because Zeno said, you've got to do you've got to do more than a billion. You've got to do a billion times a billion, but even more than that. You've got to do an infinite amount of tasks. So we want to compute where Homer will be after he's completed n of those tasks, any arbitrary number n, right? So how are we going to do this? Get how far he has left. But at some point we need to figure out either how far he has left to go or how far he has to go. So we want to get one of those. Right?
Yeah.
So the idea is to sort of generalize these couple cases. Right? So let's say this. After completing n tasks, this far on the way there. You guys agree with me? What is this going to be? First step, he travels 1/2 the way there. Then he travels 1/4, because he travels halfway up halfway. Then he travels 1/8 plus 1/2. In the last term, we do 1/2 all to the end. Everyone agree with me? Nothing too crazy down planning, I don't think. Okay, so our goal is to get a closed form for this sum. So we're going to do that with a clever trick. Let's see. So there's a trick called telescoping sums, excuse me. So what we're going to do is we're going to say 1 minus 1/2 multiply our original sum. Alright, so what are we doing? We're going to multiply this original sum by 1 minus 1 half. So 1 half. But I wrote it like 1 minus 1 half for a special reason. And that's because when you take this factor, the 1 minus 1 half, to all these terms, you get a cascade of cancellations. This is called a telescoping sum. Okay. And once we have a telescoping sum, we can simply shift that factor over. We'll have a nice closed form for what we want. So let's write it out. This is equal to 1/4 space. multiply every single term by. Every single term we multiply by 1. Let's do that real quick. We have 1 half plus 1 quarter plus 1 eighth plus dot, 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 plus 1 over 2 to the n. Okay, that takes care of this first term and all the other terms in the multiplication. Now we need to take care of this negative 1 half. So because it's a negative, I'm going to write the minus sign out front. Now we have to multiply each term by 1 half. So 1 half times 1 half is going to give us a quarter, right? Minus 1 half times a quarter gives us an eighth. Plus 1 plus 16 plus dot 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 plus 1 over 2 to the n. Didn't do anything fancy here. But what's important to see is that things are going to cancel out. What's that? Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. So you see that this term and this term are the same. This term and this term are the same. If you actually wanted to write out the sum, you see that there's a whole lot of terms that are the same. In fact, the only terms that appear in one but don't appear in the other are the first term, is the first term here, 1f, and this last term, right here. Okay, so this positive 1/4 will cancel with this negative 1/4. Positive 1/8 will cancel this negative 1/8, and so on and so forth. The only things that survive are the first and last terms. So, we have this is all equal to 1/2 minus 1 over 2 to the n plus 1, or I've just simplified this term right here. Alright, so we've shown now that this original sum times 1 minus 1 half, or times 1 half, is equal to just these two terms. That's a clever cancellation. Alright, so the only thing left to do is to bring this term to the other side by dividing both sides by 1 half, or equivalently multiplying by 2. Alright, so summary, we have that the sum k equals 1 to n plus 1 half k is equal to 2 times 1 half minus. Okay, so of course, we'll just write what this is. We have 1 minus 1 over 2 to the n. This is how far Homer has traveled. He's completed n of the tasks for arbitrary n. This is how far he's traveled. Okay, so the next slide is just giving the result I just showed. Are there any questions on that proof of that identity? You'll notice that your suggestion is basically what we got, right? You said let's try and calculate how far he has left to go after he's gone in steps. And what we get is, well, this is the total distance, and then this is subtracting what's left. So, good idea. Okay, so this next slide is just to illustrate that, well, to illustrate the utility, rather, of using this expression as opposed to trying to sum a whole bunch of other things. Now, it should be pretty clear from our intuition that it's not going to take long for Homer to get really, really close going halfway each time. After the third task, he's already seven-eighths of the way there. 34, in the grand scheme of things, is a pretty small number. But look at Alcosius. He's basically there, right? That's like past the trillions, I believe, and the fraction only differs on the last number, the single digit. Okay. So, Homer's pretty darn close, right? Zeno said that Homer had to complete an infinite amount of tasks to get where he needs to be. So he can't do it. Mathematically speaking, he was wrong. Because if you take the limit as n tends to infinity, we're going to show that he actually does reach the bus stop. He can go see the Olympic Games after all. I do want to raise a point for the philosophically inclined here. Zeno's paradox is still sort of an open question. People sort of debate this from very different viewpoints, and I think you might need to know a lot of modern physics and philosophy as well to say anything concrete philosophically about Zeno's paradox. And I don't know very much about modern physics. I'm not very good at philosophy either. But mathematically, the paradox is resolved. You can definitely say with concreteness that Homer will reach the bus stop. All right? So, as we said, after a finite amount of time, Homer's completed that much of the distance away. Rather, he's that far away from the bus stop. If we let n tend to infinity, what is this going to mean? In other words, what happens when Homer actually does complete an infinite amount of tasks? Well, what does it even mean to compute the limit as n goes to infinity of a sum? The idea is very, very important in mathematics. It's called a limit. The intuition is rather simple. There's nothing crazy behind it. So what we do is we consider finite sums for n larger and larger and larger. All right. We saw for n equals 34, he was 99.99999% of the way there. But he wasn't all the way there. However, if he were to take even more steps, he'd get even closer to 100% of the way there. The key statement is the following. To computing the limit as n goes to infinity of this sum. Statement up there. And that statement says what? That statement says by choosing n, quote unquote, big enough, the difference between the finite sum, so in other words, sum k equals 1 to infinity, 1 over 2 k minus, so let's write this a different way. 1. This we can sort of guess. The limit is going to be 1, right? This n, when n is 34, is 0.9999, whatever. The limit's going to be 1. So what we're going to say is the difference between the actual limit, which we can say in hindsight or with 20/20 vision is 1. The difference between that and the finite sum, so capital N, can be made, let's write out the rest of this, can be made arbitrarily small. Or rather, let's say, equals arbitrarily small. So the game is as follows. It's a really boring game. It's a really important game if you want to talk about limits in mathematics. The game is this. You give me a tolerance. In other words, you want the difference between 1 and this finite sum to be really, really small. You give me a tolerance. You want it to be less than, say, I don't know, 10 to the negative 30, which is 0.00, a lot of zeros. 1. 30 zeros and then 1. Maybe 29. I don't know. But the point is, a whole lot of zeros. And you say you want the difference between this and this to be less than this number. That's really small. But I say, no problem. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick this n big enough such that the difference between 1 and that sum for n big enough is actually less than this number you gave me. And we saw for n equals 34, I don't know how many decimal places it was. It definitely wasn't 30, but it was pretty darn small. So you give me, you want this smaller than 30 decimal places, I'll take n to be 340. Maybe that'll do it. Maybe that won't do it. Maybe it'll be 3,400. But the point is, I can always beat what you tell me. So you say, fine, you beat me this round. Here's what I'm going to do. I want this even smaller. I want my tolerance to be so small that you have to squeeze 60 zeros before you write a 1 here. And I say, okay, no problem. I'll just take in sufficiently large. This is the idea of a mathematical limit. It's a game. It's a really boring game, but if you can play the game, you've won the limit problem. You can solve, calculate the limit. So the game is, you name a number, I name a different number. Anything you can do, I can do better. And that's how we talk about limits. Okay? So I have this textbook definition up for anyone who's maybe seen some advanced calculus or perhaps introductory real analysis. And it's just a bunch of symbols that are saying exactly what I'm saying. The limit of this quantity, Sn, so in other words, this would be Sn, as n tends to infinity, equals some limit L, in other words, in this case, 1, if for all epsilon greater than 0, epsilon you can think of as your tolerance, for instance, 10 to the negative 60, you can pick an n big enough such that the difference is smaller than that tolerance. That's all I've been saying. Okay? So, let's see, where do we want to go with this next? Homer makes it to the bus after all, because mathematically, the limit exists, and he makes it. Now, I should mention that this thing right here, an infinite sum, is called a geometric series, and it's a really important formula in math. We use it all the time. K equals 1 to infinity of 1 over, let's call this R. There's a proof. It was almost identical to the one we gave, where you use the telescoping sum and you take a limit. The proof gives us that this thing is equal to 1 over 1 minus r. R you can think of as a ratio. There's an important caveat. R has to be between negative 1 and 1, not inclusive. Can you think of a reason why? It can't be, say, 2. What if we summed up, for instance, an infinite sum, a equals 1 to infinity of 3 to k? What if we summed up this? You know why it wouldn't work? Or otherwise, that formula wouldn't hold? Right. You get to the bus stop real soon. But guess what? Your goal was to get to the bus stop, but you actually go way farther than the bus stop, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you might end up traveling the world over, around and around. The point is, right, this is 3 plus 3 squared plus 3 cubed plus dot, dot, dot. This thing just keeps growing and growing. So this formula holds for r strictly less than 1. Because Homer did all this thinking so he can make to the bus stop. He doesn't want to go past it. He doesn't want to go way past it. He'll just be torn. Okay. So, let's see what we want now. Alright. So, back to our original question. We have the boring idea of chopping up a strip of length 1 to a finite amount of pieces, summing up those pieces, and still getting the same length. The more interesting question was, could we divide it up into an infinite amount of pieces and still get that same sum? And the answer is yes. By this formula right here, where r equals 1/2. That's what we've shown so far. All right. Are there any questions so far? Anything unclear?
You probably want the k to start from 0 over there.
Yeah, for that formula.
Yeah.
Right. So, thank you. So let's see real briefly before we move on. If you let r be 1/2, like we did, like we were examining for Homer, he's traveling 1/2 of the way there each time. Then the formula gives sum k equals 0 to infinity of 1/2 to the k is 1 over 1 minus 1/2, which is 2. So the only really silly little thing to notice is that you just change this to be k equals 1 to infinity. Not subtracting the first term when k equals 0. When k equals 0, 1/2 to the 0 the power is 1. So that's why this is equal to 1. So this is a little thing. But yes, for this formula to hold, k must be 0.
What if r is
0? So think about what happens if you're summing up 0 a bunch of times. So first, 0 to the 0 power. I actually don't know what we define that to be. Does anyone know what 0 to the 0 power is? Better define 0 to the 0th power. But, as a weird math thing, any other number n to the 0th power, that equals 1. N not equals 0.
Well, why wouldn't it be on the power? Because isn't 0 to the 0, 0 to the 1 over 0, which equals 0 over 0, which is on the power?
What do you think?
That's what I was going to say. I'm pretty sure it's undefined.
So we can't even define it, huh? Here's what we're going to say. 0 equals 0 equals evil. Your question, this 0 to 0 thing really throws a wrench in your question, but you magically change this to 1. I think you know the answer, right?
So according to that formula, it should be equal to 1.
1. Right. So here's what we're going to have to say. Good point. this formula I stated holds for R in this range, but 0 to 0 can't be defined without getting contradiction, and therefore you get something that's not even defined here equal to something that's totally defined, 1 over 1 minus 2. So that's why I say not R equals 0.
Why would it work with negative numbers?
Why can't we go down, all the way down to negative? Why can't we do numbers like negative?
So, let me ask you something. Let's say R was a negative half, so that's a negative number, right? It's between negative 1 and 1, right? Not 0, right? So it should work in the formula. The question is, why does it even work for negative numbers, right?
Then you end up getting a number like a negative answer, like the further away from the bus stop or something.
Well, here's the thing to notice. This is negative 1 half to the 0, so it's 1. This is a negative number because it's negative 1 half raised to the first power. Okay? But this is a negative number squared. So what does it mean to square a number? You have two numbers multiplied together.
Oh, that would be positive.
Positive, right?
So, negative 1 half, there would be 1, but everything else would. But the 1 from the beginning would like cancel it out or something.
The point is that this is a. Forget this term. This is a positive number. This is a negative. Sorry, I had this wrong. This is a negative number. This is a positive number. The next term will be a negative number. The term after that will be a positive number. Three negative numbers multiplied together gives you a negative number, right?
Yes, the negative times the negative is positive. And
negative
gives you.
So you get this sort of cascade of positive number, negative number. And just so happens, you can prove, similar to the proof we did to get a telescope and sum, this formula will hold, even for negative numbers. Cool. Good questions, guys. Let's consider a slightly different problem. I know we have maybe 5 minutes or so before break, but let's at least get it set up. Consider a parabola. And consider maybe a particular function 1. Let's write it up. Y equals 1 minus x squared. All right. The question is, how are we going to calculate the area of this curve, which looks something like this? This is 1, this is negative 1, it peaks at 1, and you know the graph keeps going down, something like that. What if we wanted to compute the area between the arch and the x-axis? This is, in general, not an easy problem, unless you know calculus. But if you're a brilliant ancient Greek mathematician, like Archimedes, you can be really clever. So the idea, which is very important, is approximation by simple geometric shapes. Okay? Because we know what the area of the triangle is, what we're going to do is try and break up this region into a bunch of different triangles. The idea is if we can compute the area of each triangle, we can sum up all those areas. And that will give us, if we take enough triangles, that will give us the actual area under this curve. All right? So, the algorithm is follows. Here's what Archimedes did. So the algorithm, as written up there in words, is kind of messy, so don't pay attention to it at first. Because the idea is rather simple. You start off with your parabola, okay? And here's the base of the parabola. In this case, it's just the x-axis. I picked this nice function because it's symmetric and it's good for illustration. Okay, so you start off with the base of this parabola. Then you look at the vertex. So it's obviously the top point here. This is the point 0, 1. Okay? And you want to find the line that's parallel to this axis and is tangent to this point. We don't know what tangent means. Tangent means it hits the curve at exactly one point. So, in other words, this dashed line right here is the one we want. Okay? So, what we're going to do is make a triangle from this point of tangency, this is the top point, and the two bases. They're the two points at the base. Okay, so what we're going to do is call this T0. Now from T0, we're going to make another couple triangles. So let's draw T0 again. T0. Now, here's where we have to call the algorithm a little more closely. We have this line right here, okay? And we want to find the point on this part of the curve where if we draw one little guy here, draw the line that's tangent to that point, this dotted line is parallel to this side of the triangle. Do we all see why this would be the case, right? You just pick the point where the line just kisses the point, and it's parallel to this thing. And then what we do? We say, take this point and draw below. Draw a triangle from it. So this is going to be on a T1. Similarly, on this side, pick the point, maybe here, draw the line tangent to it. This tangent line and this triangle side are parallel. What we do is draw it there. This is T3, or maybe T2. We'll use the skip 2. It'll only be skip 2. Okay? So, we're going to continually break up these regions. So it's going to be pretty darn tough to draw. But this region right here, we're also going to break up into different two more triangles. This region right here, we're going to break up right here and right here. By the theorem, I'll write down in a second, you can get a relationship between the area of this triangle, T0, and the two triangles that you make as a result of it. Okay, so we know how to compute T0. It's a triangle, T0. So I'll say A0. A0 meaning area of a zeroth triangle, T0. We know the formula for the area. 1/2 times the base times the height. We know the height is 1. And the base, well, it's 2, right? It goes from negative 1 to 1. So, we know the area of this first triangle. And by the theorem I write down, we're going to get a relationship between the area of this triangle and the area of these two triangles. If we have the relationship between those areas, we'll get an expression for T0 and T1, for the areas of those triangles, rather, because we know A0. This one, we know the areas of T2 and T1, we'll be able to get an expression for the areas of the two more triangles that we're going to get out of these four slivers. Okay, so 151, let's answer the question first. That's right. And actually, we'll see when I write down the theorem, we'll talk about it after the break. It turns out that these two triangles are equal in area. Now, for this particular function, because everything's symmetric, they'll actually be the exact same triangle. But even if you took a random parabolic arc and you try to do maybe it's more obvious that this triangle in general isn't going to look the same as this triangle.
Yeah.
Right? But by the theorem, which again we'll write down, you can get that the area of this triangle is actually equal to the area of this triangle. It's kind of cool. Then do you have a second question? Maybe we should take...
Yeah, let's take a break for 10 minutes, and we can talk to the speaker one-to-one. All right.
All the good stuff. So as promised, I wrote down this theorem, which is going to be the basis for our argument on how we actually calculate this area. Area under the parabolic curve. Okay, so this theorem says, remember, we started off with one triangle, called a T0. And from that one triangle, we got two more triangles, T1 and T2. In this case, because this parabolic arc is symmetric, the way we drew the line, it's symmetric about the y-axis, T1 and T2 are actually the same triangles. However, if you think of maybe a different parabolic arc, and you can don't have to draw lines that are sort of flat. You can draw them diagonally. In general, the two triangles you get after you get your first triangle will not be the same. However, the theorem, due to Archimedes, tells us that even though they're not the same triangles, the two triangles that result will actually have the same area. And remember, we're in the business of calculating area, so that's what we want. Okay, so in particular, it gives us the relationship between the heights and the widths of two successive triangles. And the key point is, because you're doing this process repeatedly, and maybe if you are thinking forward, you might guess that we're going to do this process an infinite amount of times, we're going to get a relationship between all the different areas of the triangles. Okay, because we know the area of the first triangle, A0, area T0, is 1, we can relate that to the next two triangles, T2 and T1. And because we know what those are, by the theorem, and by this simple calculation, we're going to know what the resulting triangles are over here. Okay, so let's try and organize all this
previously, we have area of the arch is greater than A0. Now, it should also be obvious that the area of the arch is greater than A0 plus A1 plus A2, where I'm saying that A1 and A2 are just the areas of T1 and T2. The reason I'm saying that this inequality is obvious is that, well, clearly there's these little slivers that I drew in the wiggles that are left. You're not covering the entire parabolic arc by three triangles. There's still stuff left, right? There's area left. Okay. But the key observation is, let's say we zoom in to this part of the our picture. So it's going to look something like this. Okay. So this picture right here is just this thing. And when we draw more, something like this. Okay? When we draw two more triangles, This is only one last thing. We get one triangle from this sliver, and we get another triangle from this sliver. But the point is, even when we zoom in, if we call this, T3, the triangle that's in this sliver now created more slivers, right? So in general, area of the arch, this is my point, the area of the arch is always greater than the sum of areas of triangles if you do A equals 1 to a finite number. So this is the point. The finite number, summing up finite numbers of sums of areas of triangles, is never going to give us the area of the arch. Because no matter how far we zoom in, there's always going to be slivers, right? We can always sort of zoom in on this one, and you'll always see that there'll be slivers left. Okay. So, this is sort of like Zeno's paradox, because we saw that to go from here to the bus stop, we had to go halfway. To go halfway, we had to go there, we had to go halfway from there, so it's a quarter more. And we had to go an eighth more, and so on and so forth. But for a finite sum, we never got exactly where we needed to be. So the same sort of idea is true here. But resolution will be, when we take the limit, as n goes to infinity, we'll actually cover the exact area to get an expression. So let's write down what this would be. I gave us a theorem. I said, okay, here's a procedure. Draw the one triangle, T0. Okay, once you've drawn that triangle, you want to draw two more, T2 and T1. Alright, so you're drawing two more triangles after you draw the first one. Now, on the third step, we draw a triangle in this sliver, in this sliver, this sliver, and at that point, we're going to get four more triangles. Okay? So, can you just guess the general pattern here? On the nth step, we're going to get 2 to the n more triangles. estimate this using that theorem. All right? So, as we said, the area of the first triangle is 1. 1/2 times the base times the height. Right? All right? So, using the theorem, I called in my slides T2 and T1, I called them alpha and beta. The point is, the area of the smaller triangles are 1/8 the area of the larger triangles. Alright, so we know what this area is, T0, I guess. Now we can compute the areas of this triangle and that one. They're just 1/8 times 1. Okay? Alright. So after step 1, we have the area of the first guy, 1, plus 1/8 contribution from this one, plus 1/8 contribution for this one, for a total of 5/4. Alright, again, as we said, we want an expression for when we have n steps. So here's where we finally get to have fun, hooray. I finally get to shut up and you get to do some work. Okay, so step n, as I try to convince you, there are 2 to the n more triangles. In step 1, there is 1. Or step 0, I guess, you draw 1. Step 1, you draw 2. Step 3, you draw 4. So on and so forth. As we said, the area of one of these triangles is a factor of 1/8 times the area of the previous triangles. So the exercise is to try and compute the total area AN at step N. Okay? So let's maybe have my helpers go around and get us started. But what we want to do is say an expression.
Doing
this is that it is not that you can actually do it. I remember there was a paradox where they calculate the area of the circle in two different ways. And the paradox of it is so what they did is they took it correctly. You don't mind that. They tried to approximate this line to the hexagon. And then try to make it
Someplace. They just want to make pi 3 so the math is easier for everyone.
I think he wanted us to sort of take that.
So, when you say you're
a
stranger, so this one, what did you do?
So recall we wanted to get a general formula for the total area of all our triangles that stepped in. And the way you maybe wanted to approach the problem was you start with A0. Okay? This is maybe n equals 0. Alright? Then at n equals 1, you have A0 plus 1/8. A0 plus 1/8 of A0. This is because at step 1, you have two more triangles. We have this theorem by Archimedes, which tells us that the area of these two new triangles is 1/8 the area of the old triangle. Okay? So now, n equals 2, we're going to have how many more new triangles? 4, right? We get one here, 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 and here. Okay, so we have the old stuff, which is, I'm going to write it like this. This is the old stuff from the previous level. Now we have 4 new triangles that we're adding in. Right? Because the area of all the triangles that you add in are equal. Now that's here. And they're equal to, the areas are equal to 1/8 of the previous level. So this would be 1/8 times 1/8 of A0. Right, so this is what the area of the previous triangles were, and you multiply that by 1/8. Alright, now we skip ahead to the punchline, we can rewrite our sum like that. And the first three terms that you see there are just sort of a consequence of what I was just telling you. And then, in general, as we said, you're adding 2 to the n more triangles, and they're all equal to 1/8 of the previous level. So if you sort of bootstrap backwards, you say, okay, at the highest level, the area is 1/8 of the area of the previous level. And you say, okay, that's 1/8 of the area of the previous level, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. And you get that the areas of the newest additions are 1/8 to the end. The end is the nth level. And they are 2 to the n of them, as I said. So, if you write this all together, you get that bottom expression. All right? So we can simplify this around a little bit to say that it collapses to that. It should be clear, as I try to emphasize, that at each level, if you zoom in, there's always going to be slivers of area left. You're never capturing exactly all the area. But in Zeno's paradox, he never quite made it to the bus stop, right? He got really, really close, but he never made it. So the way we resolve it is by taking the limit as n goes to infinity. Okay? And this is what Archimedes did. As we saw earlier, the sum of the geometric series is 1 over 1 minus the ratio. Alright? So the ratio here is 1/4. So, as you can see, 1 over 1 minus 1/4 is 4/3. And then I have a0, but we said a0 is equal to 1 at the beginning. So in the very end, the area under this parabolic arc is just equal to 4/3. Okay? So you might think this is pretty boring. We did all this work just to do this fraction. This is a really powerful idea that Archimedes came up with. You know, calculus wasn't invented until the 1600s or so with Leibniz and Newton. But this ancient Greek dude came up with all this nonsense way before, centuries before. It's pretty remarkable. So, here I'm basically just saying what I'm trying to hammer in is that the resolution comes when you take the limit as n goes to infinity. This is a mathematical thing that we're doing. We'll skip that. Yes. So I alluded to this game earlier, the game of you name a number, I'll name a different number. You name another number, I'll best it with another number. And the point is, this phrase in italics, arbitrarily small, is the key that we want to get at. By taking, where's the, we set our expression for the areas, and n thing is 1/4 to the k, e0, n. By taking capital N large enough, you can get arbitrarily close to the final area, which is 4/3. And this is our definition of a mathematical limit. You can get arbitrarily close to what you want to get to just by taking more and more terms in this series. Okay? Any questions? All right. So, we want to calculate the area under a more general curve. This was a really, really clever and really nice thing that Archimedes did, but it's restricted to this sort of geometric structure of the parabola. The parabola has these nice properties that he took. He went to great lengths to prove that theorem that I wrote down. And then you use the theorem, you can get the area under the curve. But if we want to do a more general curve, we can't rely on these geometric results because we don't have them in general. So a few simple examples. They're really boring. You're traveling in a car on the highway, and things are pretty mellow. The radio's playing, and the cruise control is on. All right. And I don't know about you, but I really hate long car rides. I don't like them. They're no fun. I get bored. I have trouble sleeping in the car as well. So instead of wondering how we can annoy mom and dad we're going to do is say, all right, let's see if we can't calculate how far we've gone since, I don't know, 12 noon. All right? And if the cruise control is on, you assume that the road is more or less straight and no curves. I know this isn't terribly realistic, but if you assume the road is straight with no curves, calculating the distance you travel is really simple, right? It's equal to the time you spend traveling times 70 miles an hour. What could be more elementary? I asked, what would a graph of your car's speed versus time look like? Answer is pretty obvious. You're going at a constant 70 miles an hour. You're on cruise control. Okay? So, speed versus time. And this is 70 miles per hour. Nothing crazy going on here. If you want to compute how far you've traveled in 2.5 hours, what do you do? You say, the distance that you've traveled is equal to, of course, 70 miles per hour times 2.5 hours. Okay, and this is what? This 175? 175. The reason I brought up this really simple example, 175 miles, is that if you say this is 2.5 hours, the area under this curve, this really simple, boring, constant plot, is equal to, well, it's a rectangle, so it's obviously equal to 70 times 2.5, so 175. Okay? What if you're not traveling at a constant velocity, though? What if you have some accelerations, decelerations? Maybe it's construction season. In Michigan, where I come from, you have really, really, really dreary, really difficult to driving conditions in the winter. There's no spring or fall. Well, there's fall. The other season is construction season. That's the joke. So you can basically never drive your car because the roads are either undrivable or they're being repaired because they were undrivable. Okay, so let's actually draw an example that's maybe sort of realistic, and just get that area under the curve. Let's say we have a graph. Speed versus time. And let's say that this construction zone is maybe lasting 1 hour. Okay, so we're going to break it up into 10-minute intervals. 40, 50, 10. Okay, we're going to say 70 miles per hour. 60 miles per hour. 50 miles an hour. Okay, so your car, the first 10 minutes is going 70 miles an hour. Okay, but then you see that there's a construction zone coming up ahead, so we had to slow down to 50. Alright, then we stay in the construction zone for about 10 minutes or so. We said, okay, construction's over, but we're only going up to 60. Okay, then this is at 40 minutes. We just cruise on up to 60 miles an hour for the rest of the way. So the question is, how far can we travel in this hour? Is slightly more difficult than the previous case because we're not traveling with a constant velocity the entire time, right? Between minutes 10 and 20, we had to slow down because we were entering the construction zone. So between minutes 30 and 40, we were speeding up because, well, we could. Speed limit was a little bit higher. Okay, so how far did we travel this hour? Let's compute this real quick. Note that we said that even though this is a really silly question because, well, distance is miles per hour times the amount of time traveled in hours, you can also view it as area under the curve. So for this slightly more complicated problem, we might want to use the area under the curve approach, and that will actually give us the distance that we traveled. So let's do that real quick. We might need the formula for a trapezoid. So we can recall that if we need to. I would break it up into different pieces. Try and compute the areas on the curve into different pieces. Okay, so let's take maybe 4 or 5 minutes to compute this real quick, just to warm us up. Also, I said that this is 1 hour. These units are miles per hour. So if you're at 30 minutes, that's 1 half hour. So just be careful with maybe this is 1/6 of an hour. Be careful with those.
I'm not sure why you would want to.
guys. In the interest of time, so we can cover Riemann sums at least in the last 10 minutes, does anyone have an answer? That's correct. Yeah, it agrees with me at least, so two people got it right. I'll be right.
Well, I just started to
play
through it. Yes.
But yeah, it sounds like you're definitely on something. But I don't want to go into the details. I want to talk to you after. Okay, so the idea was, you know how to compute the area of a rectangle? So that covers these three parts. And then you know how to compute the area of a trapezoid. If you don't, well, you should know how to compute, like I said, the area of the rectangle, and then you can compute the area of the triangle. I can never remember the formula, so I'll tell you. Okay, so yeah, you just add it all up, and you should get something that looks like this. Okay, but this is for more sort of simple curves. In general, your car's sort of velocity versus time graph might not look so pleasant with linear and acceleration and whatnot. It might be a little bit more wavy. So in general, if we want to compute the distance we cover in a car with this sort of velocity versus time plot, what are we going to do? In other words, how are we going to compute this shaded region, the area of this shaded region, that is? Remember Archimedes' approach. What he did was he said, let's approximate this parabolic arc by the area of that parabolic arc, rather, by areas of triangles. Do you know how to compute areas of triangles? And you got a clever relationship between some sequence triangles, and you got his answer. So Riemann sums, which is basically how the definite integral is defined, in the Riemann sense at least, use this approach, but they use rectangles. The rectangles are really great. Because, well, it's just length times width is the area. So let's draw some pictures. We have our curve, it's nice and wavy, and this is time versus velocity. We want to estimate the area on this curve. You want to estimate this stuff, right? So what we're going to do is say, let's take some rectangles, maybe four rectangles for starters. Right? So I'm going to say rectangle here, here, and here. Alright, so what I'm going to do is draw vertical lines on these grid marks. Okay, I have four divisions. Alright, and we can say maybe this is x0, this is x1, or let's use t. t0, t1, t2, t3, using T4. Alright, so we want to find the distance this car has traveled between time T0, which you can find as T0, and some other time T4, some time in the future. Alright, so the way we're going to estimate it is we're going to take the value of the function on this side of the rectangle and make the rectangle. We're going to take the value of the function right here and make that a rectangle. Similarly, we're going to take the value of the function here, make that a rectangle, and the value of the function here, make that a rectangle. Now, it's not necessarily a very good approximation, but the green region is an approximation nonetheless of the region of 1. Okay? So you can probably guess where I'm going to be taking this. And it's as follows. We use n equals 4 right there. What if we use n equals 8? Or n equals 16? Or n equals 256? I'm not going to draw 256, but I will draw a couple of examples, and it should be clear that we're going to get a better approximation. Let's try to draw the curve reasonably the same. Something like that. Then I'm going to do the same thing. Draw rectangles here, 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 here. And then if I shade in this region, see, still a pretty crude approximation, but it's an approximation nonetheless. Better approximation nonetheless is what I wanted to say. So, again, you can see where I'm taking this. If we take n to be 16, we're going to get an even better one. Okay? And how are we going to estimate how get area of the estimation? The approximation. So we have, let's do this case, four rectangles, right? We know how to compute the area of a rectangle. So if I call this rectangle 1, 2, 3, 4, the area of 1 is the base times its height. Okay, so the base, every time, I'm going to say this is a constant delta t. Greek letter delta is usually denotes like a change in. So it's saying the change in time between t2 and t3 is just some quantity delta t. Could be 4 minutes, 4 hours, just depends on what we're working with. But the key thing is, this is the base of this rectangle, and all the bases are equal. In other words, I'm choosing my t0, t1, t2, t3, t4 to be such that the difference between them are all the same. Okay, so area of rectangle 1 is equal to its base, just delta t, here times its height. The height, we said, we're going up value t1, okay, and we're going to take it all the way up to the value of the function at t1. So the height is nothing other than a function f at t1. Now I should say we'll call this function f at t dot b. Okay, this arbitrary function. Starts wiggling and goes up, and wiggles down, and goes up again. Okay, and the area of this first rectangle is just the value of that function at this point t1 times the base, which is delta t. All right, and in general, of course, the area of rectangle I is delta t times f at t sub I. I is just a dummy variable here. It's shorthand for either the first one, when you have f at t1, the second one, the third one, and the fourth one. Alright, so the total estimation, the approximation to the area under the curve that we really want, is equal to the sum of all the areas of the rectangle. Any questions on what's going on so far? In this case, this is n equals 4. So I should maybe call this n equals 4. All right, so nothing complicated is going on. We're just saying, let's mark off our function at 4 different values and draw rectangles based on those values. Once we draw rectangles based on those values, we're just going to get that the approximation to the area is the sum of the areas of those rectangles. Okay? So, in general, well, let's write down the base. N equals 8, you'd have the sum as 1 to n equals 8 of delta t and f at ti equals approximately the area under f of t. These two pictures should agree intuitively with what these formulas are saying. Base times height. Just areas of the simplest things we can think of, rectangles. Okay. So, can you guess how we might define a definite integral? Hopefully, there is a pattern that's going on in our lectures, and that would be. What do you think? That's exactly it. So this picture is meant to be another illustration of what I'm saying, so it's a lot easier to draw on a computer, really thin strips. But as you can see, if you're taking the number of rectangles, in other words, n, if you're taking that to be larger and larger, the area under the curve is better and better approximated. So we define our definite integral to be the limit as n goes to infinity of this sum. So let me write it out. The Riemann sum times f 4, or instead of 8, we have n, like they have up there. N equals 4, probably 8, 16, 32, maybe. Alright, so, as he just pointed out, what we want to do is make the definition the limit as we take an infinite number of slices, infinite number of rectangles. In other words, this I will define, well, by name, I guess, to be the definite integral. This is called an integral sign, and it looks kind of like an S, doesn't it? And so you can maybe picture this summation sigma, which also sort of looks like an S. Maybe you straighten it out a little bit, curve the edges a little bit, and voila, you've got the integral. These two are very much connected. They're connected by this limit. So maybe one or two more words, or I don't think we have time for the application, unfortunately. But the idea is very simple. You want to estimate some quantity. For instance, as we said, how far we travel in our car. And for very simple sort of cases, you can calculate it, no problem. You have constant miles per hour, you're going at a constant rate for a certain fixed time, you can calculate how far you go. But in general, things can be a little bit more complicated. And your function that you're trying to integrate could look nice and wacky. Like that. Who knows? So the point is, we don't know how to do this by hand, but what we do know how to do, what we do know how to do by hand are these Riemann sums. If you know the values of your function, all we need to do is compute the area of each rectangle, add them all up. Computing the area of the rectangle is very simple. Adding up a finite number of things is also very simple. That's this guy. Then, as we tried to sort of describe in the case of Zeno's paradox and the estimation of the area under a parabolic curve, you'll never actually perfectly capture all the area unless you take n to be infinity. So you'll see in some of those pictures, some of the rectangles are overestimations. Some of the rectangles are underestimations. And if you keep refining n, so if you take n to be 32, or 256, or 1024, if you keep refining n, you'll never actually capture it completely, unless you take the limit, because n goes to infinity. And that's what happens when Homer walks halfway, and a quarter way, and an eighth way. When he takes the limit to infinity, he actually gets to the bus stop. So take the limit as n goes to infinity of Archimedes' triangles, you actually get the area under the parabola. So that's really all calculus is. Doing some fancy filler limits and taking some basic intuition about everyday life, turning into rigor. So thanks for listening. Sorry we didn't get to, we had a really cool example of volumes of revolution, but if you want to stay after, I'd be happy to talk.